Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Eric Garner's family, including a daughter, is calling for New York officials to now fire the policeman they say killed him.
We call the Department of Justice. They didn't do their job. So no, I'm going to stand outside and I'm going to scream it. Pantaleo needs to be fired. He needs to be fired.
Backing up, Eric Garner died 5 years ago today. His last words, "I can't breathe." Cell phone video shows Officer Daniel Pantaleo putting a chokehold on Garner and a scrum of officers taking Garner down because he objected to being arrested again for selling loose cigarettes. Yesterday, Attorney General William Barr stepped into a dispute between his own Civil Rights Division prosecutors who wanted an indictment of Officer Pantaleo and New York prosecutors who felt they couldn't win such a case, Barr overriding his own prosecutors, blocking any charges. Matt Zapatosky covers the Justice Department for The Washington Post. Matt, what did Barr say about why he decided not to bring charges?
Well, Barr, through the U.S. attorney up in New York, basically said that they couldn't come up with the evidence to substantiate federal civil rights charges. It's a difficult thing, proving federal civil rights charges. You have to prove that the officer used unreasonable force, and maybe that's not so hard here, but also that they acted willfully. In other words, while he's got Garner in this sort of chokehold, he knows that that's wrong and he continues to do it. You have to have proof of that or evidence of that. And Barr felt that they didn't have that so that they couldn't bring a case.
Let's be clear. Barr also said Garner's death was a tragedy, as did the head of New York's largest police union. An undeniable tragedy is what he called it, but saying again, Pantaleo did not cause it. Barr saying he couldn't prove it was caused by Pantaleo. But isn't a chokehold illegal?
Well, a chokehold is banned under New York police policies. The U.S. attorney in New York, who is sort of describing how this went down, says that Pantaleo used two kind of authorized techniques to take Garner down. But then after he kind of gets slammed into a window, he wraps his arm fully around Garner's neck. And the U.S. attorney describes that as, in effect, a chokehold. That would be sort of prohibited under New York police policies. We'll see what happens to Pantaleo. Employment because of that. He went through a trial board last month, I think, and it's kind of up to police officials now to decide what to do with his employment status.
And the family is calling for him to be fired. Is it unusual for an attorney general to make final prosecution calls like this? And to overrule his own civil rights division.
Yeah, not when prosecutors disagree. I mean, this is kind of a classic case of U.S. attorneys, the federal prosecutors across the country having one view and then people at Main Justice, in this case the civil rights division, having a different view. That is actually more common than you'd think. And when that happens, the deputy attorney general, the number two in the department, or in super high profile cases like this one, the attorney general has to step in. He was up against a statute of limitations issue too. Today, the five-year anniversary, the statute of limitations would have run. Many attorneys general just kind of kicked this down the line, and there is Barr on the eve of the statute of limitations has to make a call.
Yeah. And of course, Pantaleo has many supporters who say he was an impossible situation, that he had come into after it was already underway. Officers had confronted Eric Garner for selling loose cigarettes, which is illegal, but it's a petty crime. And this decision by Barr comes as we watch another case against financier and convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, charged again with sex trafficking. Garner had police pile on him. Epstein didn't interact with the police. He had a DA who gave him a sweetheart deal, a lesser plea, 13 months in jail. This is back in Florida in 2008. Yeah. He was in jail nights only in a special wing. He could leave during the day. Are you hearing bubbling up a comparison between these two cases and, inequality in the criminal justice system?
Well, these are two very distinct episodes. I mean, Eric Garner, of course, has a very brief run-in with the justice system. He never makes it to jail because he's taken down and dies in the process of that. So it's very tough to compare his case to that of Jeffrey Epstein's. The allegations, of course, you know, are on just totally different – in totally different universes. Jeffrey Epstein is accused in the past and now of sexually abusing dozens of minor girls. Eric Garner is accused of selling untaxed cigarettes. So it's hard to compare them, but these are two big high-profile issues that the Justice Department has to grapple with. And in Epstein's case in particular and how it was handled in the past, I think it's pretty evident that when you're a person of incredible means and can hire great defense attorneys, you get to see parts of the justice system that people with lesser means don't ever get to see.
Matt Zabotosky covers the Justice Department for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, we reported last week on a bankruptcy filing by Black Jewel, the country's sixth largest coal producer, 600 people out of work in Wyoming. It's becoming a familiar story in mining communities as natural gas supplants coal as the country's primary energy source. Take the tiny community of Nucla, Colorado. When the Tri-State Mining Company announced it would be phasing out coal operations there a few years back, people thought the town would dry up. But as Stina Sieg reports from Colorado Public Radio, some residents are trying to make sure that doesn't happen.
Nucla residents Donna Morris and Jane Thompson remember how they felt that day, the day they heard coal was leaving.
Got sick to my stomach.
It was like, how can this happen again? Mm-hmm.
Again, because Nucla has been through this before. The biggest thing here was uranium, and in its heyday from the 40s through the 70s, this area was bustling. Thompson describes the sense of security mining brings.
But at the time, you think things are going to boom forever. They'll always need uranium. They're always going to need coal.
But always isn't really a word you can use with mining. After uranium prices tanked in the late 70s, the mines closed. And so did shops and bars, both movie theaters. Hundreds of people moved away. This part of the state, known as the West End, never really recovered. And a few years ago, a new blow arrived when Tri-State Generation agreed to shut down Nucla's power plant and the coal mine that supplies it to settle a clean air lawsuit. The mine closed earlier this year. The plant will shutter in 2022. In all, more than 80 jobs will be lost. Morris has been Nucla's mayor for 11 years, and at first she thought this would be the death knell for this place.
That doesn't last very long because, you know, we're fighters. We have to pick our britches out and just keep going.
Plenty of people here hope mining returns in some form. The local paper still prints the price of uranium on its front page. But even if it does, Jane Thompson says the town can't depend on any one thing anymore.
We have to be a little more diverse.
And look to what the area has to offer above ground.
Here's a great view of the San Juans.
Oh, yeah. Paul Koski guides me through a section of the Paradox Trail, overlooking a vast expanse of rocky desert, dotted with blooming cacti. He and other volunteers built this route, which hooks up with hundreds of miles of other trails. He says some locals are still skeptical of the value of attracting outdoor recreation.
But for the most part, I think people realize that we have to do something. And we have to do something fairly soon. That time's running out for us.
Koski's lived in Nucla for 40 years, and what keeps him here is what he thinks will entice other outdoorsy types. Dark skies, wide open spaces, more cows than people.
Because we are so wilderness-like, so isolated, that's what we have to offer people, is that solitude. There's so much public land here, and that's our gem.
The key, he says, is letting people know this area exists. That's where Dina Sheriff comes in.
If you like the type of stuff that you'd find in Moab, but you don't want the crowds, this is where you should be.
That's one of the snappy lines Sheriff uses to help market this place. But outdoor tourism can't be the only thing in Nucla's future, she says. She's with the West End Economic Development Corporation, which started only a few years ago and whose work has become more urgent after the news of the power plant and mine closing. The organization has started offering classes for locals looking to start their own small businesses. The hope, she says, is to help people develop a vision beyond mining.
you're going to be able to do something that you want to do, and you'll do it by choice.
So far, nearly 30 businesses are in the works. And Sheriff says entrepreneurs from out of town are interested, too. One industry that has its eye on the area is cannabis. Two dispensaries are in the works, plus a hemp co-op. Most of this is still to come. But Sheriff says locals are already starting to see things pick up here.
Even if just noticing that you're having to stand in line at the hardware store, you know, you didn't have to do that 3 years ago.
The area is seeing more investment, too. It's won a bunch of grants to develop its airport and beautify parks, and residents themselves have set up a charitable fund to support local organizations, like a new early learning center. The hope is that these efforts will ensure this community doesn't need coal or uranium, even if mining makes a comeback. Nuclear Mayor Donna Morris says her little town has something plenty of people want, a quiet life.
Because when you go 2 hours in any direction, you are in a city, and it is very hustle-bustle and very fast-paced.
To be clear, Morris is talking about the small cities of Grand Junction and Montrose.
And most people find that once you start living here and you go to those places, coming back home is the best thing in the world.
And Morris and others are working toward a new future for their home, a future beyond the cycles of boom and bust. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg, reporting from Nucla, Colorado.
Here and Now is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single-serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and any time in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box when you go to dailyharvest.com and use promo code NOW. That's dailyharvest.com. Use promo code NOW.
We've been talking with presidential candidates ahead of next year's election. Today, Democratic Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey joins us. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. It's really great to be on. I always get excited when I'm on the shows that I actually listen to.
Oh, awesome. Well, it's great to have you. Now, for the last several days, one of the things we and a lot of other people in the media have been talking about, the news cycle has been all about the president's tweets, his racist tweets. And they've shined more light on some of the more liberal members of the Democratic caucus, which is something the president probably wants to do. How do you deal with that if you're the nominee? His ability to control the narrative and fight an election on the issues that he wants.
Well, first of all, I'm glad you identified exactly what he's doing. He is trafficking in racism, using it as a weapon to prey upon minorities and women and ethnic minorities as a way to gain power. And the question is how have we defeated folks like that before? I am a person who grew up around a kitchen table with two black parents who taught me not just about the hate, but how it was defeated. We didn't beat Bull Connor by bringing bigger dogs and fire hoses. We did it because we had these creative artists of activism that appealed to the larger moral imagination of this country. I'm saying quite simply, this election is not a referendum on Donald Trump and his spewing of racist and bigotry. It's really a referendum on who we are and who we are to each other. And we will beat him.
But how do you get that, though, on the front page? How do you get what you're talking about to be more important to the media than what he's tweeting if it's outrageous?
Well, again, for me, my focus is the people and what I've done in the past in trying to get people to change their moral imagination about cities and places to turn around, dramatically turn around an area like Newark that used to not be able to get everything from institutional capital to philanthropy. We were able to change people's opinions, not by focusing first on the media. That's not the end. The end is the people, and the media will follow.
Okay, so why have you not been able to gain more traction in your campaign? You're still around 1 or 2% in the polls. Why, for example, has Kamala Harris, who's also new to a lot of voters, been able to rise up higher than you in the polls?
You and I both know that every single presidential candidate going back to before Carter were always considered the lesser polls or long shots. Bill Clinton, Jimmy Carter, even a guy named Barack Obama. We are so far out from this election. We're still introducing ourselves. We have barely over 50% name recognition. But when people get to hear my message, we tend to pop. When we came off the last debate stage, it was our best days of fundraising, and we saw a surge in endorsements. we've got the right message and we're going to win those early primary states and go on to win the nomination.
Okay, so let me ask you about some issues that are out there. Which country in the world do you think poses the biggest threat to the U.S. right now, either economically or militarily?
I think the biggest threat to our nation right now is our inability to create new American majorities necessary to meet global and local threats, to take on nuclear proliferation, to take on the urgency of climate change, to take on the insidious actions of Russia, who's working right now using techniques on our social media platforms to actually try to make us hate each other more.
So you did mention Russia there. Does that come to the top of your mind as the biggest threat that America faces?
Look,
right
as
now,
a guy who sits on the Foreign Relations Committee mm-hmm. and reads these intelligence reports, I can go through a threat analysis from North Korea to China's insidious trade policies, to Russia, to even some of the European destabilization we're seeing with countries shifting towards authoritarianism from Turkey to Hungary. So we have a lot of challenges that we have to step up and have global leadership. And this president, unfortunately, he calls it America first, but it's really America isolated. He's pulling away from our alliances or international agreements, from the Paris Climate Accords to the Iran deal, mm-hmm. and pushing us towards a more isolated position and creating more danger and even chaos in the world, as you see the Iranians now pushing and rushing towards getting a nuclear weapon. A president is dragging us a counter to our allies and further towards the drumbeat of war.
Well, so let's say if the trade war with China were still going on and you become president in 2021, would you end it?
China is not only a threat using the trade practices, the stealing of our intellectual property, and many of their other bad practices. They're not just a threat to the United States. They're undermining Western Europe and Eastern Europe. They're undermining Canada and Mexico. But this president has literally said to us, we're going to take on China. At the same time, we're going to put tariffs on our allies as well. So we've used a national security waiver to put tariffs on Canada. Now, I know Trudeau might be threatening to people like me because he's got this great hair and I'm a bald man. But Canada's not our enemy. We need to be uniting with others in common cause against China, people who have our same values and believe in the same rules. And if I'm going to take on China, I'm going to take it on with our allies who represent more than half of our global economy. And we're going to win that fight.
You have a reputation among some as a senator who is close to the pharmaceutical industry. For example, you voted against a bill from Senator Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar that would have allowed Americans to buy cheap prescription drugs from Canada. How do you counter that? Or do you say that that's not true, that you're close to Big Pharma?
Well, I don't need to say that's not true because PolitiFact has actually taken on that exactly what you just said and mm-hmm. called it wrong. I have never done anything to stop importations. In fact, the bill to allow safe importations into our country was actually written by me and Senator Sanders together. I live in an inner city, low-income neighborhood and have represented most of my career people who are struggling every day. I've seen the anguish of people putting aside insulin drugs or life-saving medication because they can't afford it. As mayor, I fought to lower prescription drug prices. I've always been in favor of not just importation, but taking a much stronger fight against the pharmaceutical industries. I'm a co-sponsor of a bill that would take away their patents if they're raising their drugs in this country higher than others.
Do you think that they bear some responsibility for the opioid crisis?
Absolutely. If I'm president of the United States, my DOJ will be going after them to hold them accountable. This is one of the reasons why in this campaign I've said, look, I'm not going to take pharma C-suite executive money. I'm not taking their lobbyist money. I'm not taking corporate PAC money because I want every American to know when I'm your president, I'm going to take on those powerful corporate interests that are corrupting our politics on everything from the folks who are in the mortgage industries. I see it across this country in farm country, these large companies, Monsanto and others, that are eroding the farmer's share of the consumer dollar. We're seeing this rise in corporate power in this country that is undermining not only free markets, but undermining the well-being of workers, undermining the well-being of consumers. And we need a president that is going to take on those issues. And the opioid crisis right now, which has been fueled, put on steroids by these insidious actions of pharmaceutical companies trying to make profits by pouring ungodly amounts of these medicines mm-hmm. out there, marketing in ways that distorted the needs. They will pay for their crimes, and I use that word crimes purposefully. That is going to be part of my agenda to solve the crisis.
Okay, let me just ask you quickly, because I know we've got limited time, but let me ask you two questions about the next generation. 1 in 5 high school students now vapes. Do you think that vaping ought to be regulated like cigarettes, or should it be the government's role to stop kids from getting hooked on nicotine?
I think that this is yet another way that tobacco companies are coming back, trying to get folks addicted. In the same way with cigarettes, it poses a problem. And yes, there should be regulation and accountability, because we pay for it. And seeing that what happens to kids who get addicted on this, and it erodes their quality of life and their life expectancy, we pay for it through medical costs. Mm-hmm. I believe in individual freedom, but I also believe in holding corporations accountable for their marketing, especially when you're doing it in an irresponsible, harmful fashion to people who are underage.
Okay, so then let me bring you to another issue of what many would call addiction now among especially young people, but really everybody. How much time do you spend online or on a device?
I've taken those apps before that have measured the time and then took them off of my phone.
It's scary to look at those sometimes.
It really is, and we do not know what this is doing to brains, and we do not know what it's doing to brains in development. And I think that's something that we should be studying and investing our common resources in understanding its impact. I do know that we have an industry that should be regulated when you have these large tech companies who work every single day in trying to design and even gamify these platforms in order to capture more and more of people's attention. I worry about everything from how they're using our private information against us. I think there should be a lot of regulation in that area. I think that it's worrisome how our foreign adversaries are using these platforms to attack our democracy. Again, as a guy who came up through politics representing low-income, mostly minority areas, mm-hmm. when I know I have legislation trying to stop some of this, how these algorithms are being designed, often with impacts that have that solidify in the tech world racism now, or institutional bias, or bias against low-income folks, or bias against women or people of color, mm-hmm. that a lot of the ways our information is being used is a violative of our common values as a country, and also could hurt people in terms of access, whether it's to banking or mortgages or educational opportunity. We have got to get into this space and create a set of rules and fairness.
Okay, one last question, Cory Booker. And I'm only asking you this because when we interviewed Pete Buttigieg, I asked him if he thought America was ready to elect a gay president. Do you think that America is ready to elect the first bachelor president since James Buchanan back in the 1850s?
I was about to start cracking up because I thought you were going to ask me, is America ready for the first vegan president?
Oh, okay.
There's so many things about me that I think are unique. I was sort of bracing myself for where you
where
would
I was going to go with that. Okay.
I'm in a serious relationship right now. Let's hold the jury out before you ask that question to see where mm-hmm. Rosario and I are in about a year or so from now.
New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, Democrat running for president. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Protesters in Puerto Rico plan to rally against the island's governor again today. They've called for Governor Ricardo Rosselló to step down over leaked private messages he sent that used homophobic and misogynistic slurs. Yesterday, Rosselló spoke about a large demonstration near the governor's mansion Monday night.
People were able to express their message, a message mostly against me, but my commitment is to defend that right to express, you know, whatever position the people that are protesting have.
Adrian Florido of NPR's Code Switch team joins us now from San Juan. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Jeremy.
So it appears, at least for now, that the governor is not going to resign.
That's right. At that same press conference we just heard tape from, he reiterated that he will not resign. And that is, you know, despite mounting pressure coming to bear on him from protesters who held this huge demonstration on the streets surrounding the governor's mansion, a protest that ended in confrontations between protesters and police with tear gas and some injuries. And despite what is clearly a growing movement to force Rosselló from office, he has said that he will not step down.
So what's been the reaction to that in Puerto Rico?
Well, it's been to step up the pressure to keep the momentum of these protests going. Like you mentioned, there's another one planned for tonight, and this one is expected to be huge, in part because some of Puerto Rico's most important artists and athletes are calling on protesters to come out. People like the trap artist Bad Bunny, singer Ricky Martin, They have flown into Puerto Rico to join the march today, and that's what makes it feel like the momentum to force the governor to step down is only growing, not dying down.
Now, we remember seeing the governor a lot after Hurricane Maria. He's been dealing with the fallout from that. He's also been dealing with Puerto Rico's bankruptcy proceedings. And then this scandal came to light. Some 900 pages of private messages were released. A lot of it we can't even say on the radio. But tell us how this scandal came to light in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, I mean, it was only like the latest sort of black eye for the governor in what was a span of a couple of weeks that saw all kinds of sort of mini scandals popping up. One of them had come out just a couple days earlier. The FBI had arrested two of his former top officials on corruption charges. That was a big scandal for about a day and a half until these chats were published by the local Center for Investigative Journalism. And they, like you said, are really bad. They show the governor and members of his inner circle using these terrible misogynistic terms to refer to women and political opponents. They use homophobic language to refer to people, including singer Ricky Martin. They crack jokes about the hurricane dead, which was something that was so sensitive and continues to be a very sensitive topic for Puerto Rican citizens. And one of the things that I've heard in the last several days of protest on the streets when I talk to people is that they feel like these chats sort of lifted the curtain on the governor and sort of showed people that he doesn't actually care about them or the struggles that they're facing because of the economic crisis that Puerto Rico is in.
Well, and even if he doesn't resign as a result of this, he is up for re-election next year.
He is up for re-election next year. Many of his allies in the government have already asked for his resignation, and even those who haven't have said that he probably shouldn't run for re-election. I mean, the governor has made very clear that he plans to run for re-election, and it really is clear that this is going to be bad for him.
That is Adrian Florido of NPR's Code Switch team joining us from San Juan, Puerto Rico. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Athletes are gathering this week in Rock Springs, Wyoming, to compete in the National High School Rodeo Finals. Here in Now's Peter O'Dowd got to spend some time in the arena with a few of the best young cowboys and cowgirls in the world.
Dark clouds are building in the red desert of southwestern Wyoming, but these broncs can't be bothered by a little bad weather. A week's worth of championship rodeo is just hours from getting underway.
This is the largest rodeo in the world. We host over 1,600 contestants this year, about 1,800 entries, and we have kids coming from 43 states, 5 Canadian provinces, Australia, and Mexico.
Gary Hawks is with the National High School Rodeo Association, the group that organizes this event. He brought me to the edge of the main outdoor arena where a group of feisty horses is getting turned out from the corrals.
Rodeo's all year round for these kids. Our season starts August 1st. As soon as this rodeo ends, we kind of give them a few weeks to relax and rest, and then they hit the road hard and go all year round, and we'll travel and hit all the rodeos in their states, surrounding states, and then come here about in July.
Paying three in the round, four places in the average. Prizes for the top three in the average.
$180,000 in college scholarship money is on the line for the top steer wrestlers, barrel racers, pole benders, and bull riders. So what do we got here?
So this is Eminem. He's my main goat horse, my rodeo horse. He's gotten me the farthest. I won the state championship on him.
Paige Rasmussen traveled to Wyoming with her mom and two horses from Bozeman, Montana. Behind us, an announcer is watching over a roping session.
And then this is Felix. He's my younger horse. I trained him on the goats. He is kind of a backup horse this week and a buddy horse, so then my good horse wouldn't have to travel alone.
They like to be with another horse?
Yes. Yep. And so I brought him just in case something happened to my good horse and I have a backup, I wouldn't have to borrow a horse.
Now, did I hear your mom say one of your horse's legs was swelling up a little bit?
Yeah, my good horse's leg, he kicked a panel. It was a little swollen. We were a little worried about it, but he came out of it, so he'll be 100%.
So he's ready to go for the competition?
Yep, he's looking pretty excited.
He looks pretty calm right now. Does Eminem know, like, when it's go time, like, when it's time to compete?
Yeah, he knows. He's pretty laid back, but when the lights go down and the rodeo starts, he gets pretty jacked up.
Eminem gets jacked up for goat tying. That's Rasmussen's main event. And what is that exactly?
So there's a goat on the end of a rope, and he'll be staked out at the end of the arena. And what we do is we ride in on our horses, and we actually dismount our horses as they're running, and we run into the goat. We catch him on the end of the rope, and we tie his three legs together with a string. It's called a piggin string.
And how's it judged? Is it purely by time?
Yes, just by time.
Purely by time. Are you pretty good?
Yeah, I am.
Now, you had to get off the horse while it's running?
Yes.
And what's that like? And how do you do that without getting hurt?
Lots of conditioning your body and working out, lifting weights, just making sure your body is strong enough to handle that. And you can go any speed, but the faster you go, more likely you're going to win. So if you can get your body to where it can handle those high rates of speed and getting off, then you're going to be better off.
How fast is your horse going? Is it at full sprint while it's heading towards that goat?
Yes, full sprint. I whip him down until I get off, so he's at full speed. I don't slow him down at all.
Okay. And how did you get into something like that?
My dad works for the professional bull riders. He's an entertainer, so he's like the clown.
He's the clown.
Yes, sir.
Now, that's like the iconic rodeo character, right?
Yeah.
So you just kind of grew up steeped in all of this.
Mm-hmm.
What's rodeo mean to you?
Rodeo is more than just a sport to me. It's a lifestyle, and it's really made me a better person. I've been able to experience things that other kids my age will never be able to.
Mom Katie Rasmussen explains why.
It's unlike any other sport. Any other sport, you go to practice, you're done. After they practice this sport, they got to take care of the horses. In the morning, they got to take care of the horses. In the afternoon, it's there's no off season because they got to take care of their horses. It's quite a physical and mental challenge.
Well, it looks like a kind of a financial investment as well. This is, does not look like a cheap sport. You've traveled with these animals. There's a lot of infrastructure in place here, trailers, gear, equipment. How much of a, I don't want to say a burden, but how much of a financial investment is it to make sure that your daughter can do this?
It is quite a financial a burden for some more than others. For me, it helps my business because I raise, train, and sell rodeo horses. So it does help. Both girls have attained full ride scholarships to a major university. Although we joke with the money we've invested, we could have probably sent them to Harvard three times. So it is a huge financial investment, but it teaches them a great deal, and it's definitely worth it.
Rasmussen's full-ride rodeo scholarship is at Montana State University, where she'll start classes in the fall. And if her family made an investment to compete here, check out what this guy had to do.
I'm Zane Hall from Australia, Queensland, third-generation cowboy.
Zane Hall and his dad took three airplanes to get here.
I've been doing rodeo ever since I was a little kid, back home in Australia, and my pop and dad, we all contract bucking horses and bucking bulls.
So this is in your blood?
Yeah. I just live for it.
And that's why Hall is here. He's a bull rider. By the way, how old are you?
17.
You're 17 and you're going to be hopping on the back of a bull. What's that like?
You get heaps of adrenaline rush from it. It's pretty much why heaps of cowboys do it, I guess.
It's all about the adrenaline. I mean, like, that's the only reason to do it. Right?
It's not the only reason, but it's one of them.
Okay, so tell me what it's like when you, like, right before you're getting going and you know that chute's going to open. What are you feeling? What are you thinking?
Before you get on the bull, you just sort of, I always like to muck around with my mates behind the chutes, and you just don't think about it.
Because that takes some of the pressure off or the stress away?
Absolutely, whatever you want to call it. And then when I get down on the bull, I sort of click into gear and get my head in the right space, hold on for the 8 seconds.
How old were you when you first got on a bull?
No, I was 9 years old when I got on my first potty calf.
What is that? I bet a lot of people won't know what that is. I don't know what that is.
It's like a bull, but it's newborn, so it's only like 9 months old.
It's not so mean.
Yeah.
You got to stay on for 8 seconds, right? I mean, is that, do you normally make it that long, or do you get thrown pretty regularly?
I try and hold on for as long as I can. Like, all the cowboys, they always say ride them for 10, just so you know you made the 8, but try and do the best I can.
And have you ever gotten hurt?
Lots of times.
Yeah, tell me about that.
I've had 2 broken arms, a broken foot. I've been knocked out cold 3 times. And, yeah, it's not fun, but that's what happens in bull riding.
Why do you get back up?
I'll live for it.
And get back on.
Yeah. I just love the sport, and we take good care of these bulls, and I love it. It's in my blood.
Hall competed in last year's bull riding event, but he wasn't happy with his performance. This will be his last chance at a high school title, and a lot will depend on what bull he draws.
Yeah, so it's 50 points on the rider and 50 points on the bull. So if you got a good bull and you're riding it terrible, hanging down the side, you're not going to get a good score on my behalf.
But the meaner and the wilder the bull is, the better your score can be.
Yeah, correct.
So when you get assigned to your bull, what are you hoping for? Are you hoping for the biggest, nastiest bull, or do you kind of want the one that's going to go a little easier on you?
It's sort of good to just get a nice bull in the first two rounds, but in the short go, you probably want a rank bull just to get a good score. And
do the bulls have reputations?
100% they do, yeah.
A few hours later, the sun has set in the Red Desert, the earlier storm has passed, and now stadium lights flood the main outdoor arena.
Zane Hall of Queensland, Australia.
Thousands of spectators watch from the grandstands as the 17-year-old from a world away gets ready for his first ride.
The Australians, are any Australians here with us tonight?
The chute opens.
Rodeo Mocking Bull here we go, the Aussie.
4 seconds later, and Hall is in the dirt. The bull stomped down on his foot, and the rider limps away. No score. It's not a good start, and it might ruin his chances for the rest of the week. But he'll get up, and he'll ride again. He always does. For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Rock Springs, Wyoming.
A recent discovery by scientists at the University of Arizona seems to show the HIV virus has been active for over a century. According to our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication, the genetic code for the virus was found in tissue from a 38-year-old, which was preserved when he died in the 1960s, and it's a genetic sequence a decade older than the previous oldest one. Michael Warby heads the team that carried out the work. Dr. Warby, welcome. Congratulations.
Thanks. Hi, Robin.
Because this feels like it hasn't been peer-reviewed yet, we should say, your reporting, but it feels like very important work. And when I say that this was a virus from a 38-year-old male from the 60s, it was snipped from a lymph node and sealed in a protective block of paraffin. First of all, why does this even exist?
Its existence has nothing to do with HIV because it was preserved long before anyone knew about the virus. This is actually a routine thing that happens when people go in for a biopsy. A little bit of that tissue is typically fixed in preservatives and then encased in wax and then just stored in the basement of the hospital and allow us, in this case, to travel back in time and actually see what HIV looked like in the 1960s.
And so did you have any clue that this paraffin, when opened up, might have this inside it, this little, I understand, like a less than a thumbnail of genetic information? Could you guess what might be there?
We hoped. We actually screened more than 1,000 samples in the capital, Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of the Congo, where we think the virus was diversifying at a very, very early point. Further back in time you go, the less likely it is that anyone sampled will have the virus. But we got this one sample that was of high quality that we could stitch together the genome of the virus from it.
So, yeah, you tease out of this tissue a nearly complete genetic sequence of an HIV virus, HIV-1. First of all, we understand you've been working on this for 5 years. What were you doing for 5 years? I mean, what did this entail?
It's sort of two things. It's improving the methods so that you actually don't miss the virus when you screen for it. So the good thing about these preservatives is that they preserve material well enough that there is some genetic material left from the virus. The bad thing is that they do horrible things to the RNA of the virus. They mince it up into small pieces and make it very hard to recover using molecular biology. Once we had knowledge that this sample was positive, then it was many years of just slowly, piece by piece, the whole genome's about 10,000 nucleotides, and some of the pieces that we, individual pieces that we amplified, were less than 100 nucleotides. And it just takes a lot of toil to do it this way.
Well, explain this, because this man, who obviously died in the 60s, it's his tissue, was in his 30s. But the conclusion is that the HIV virus that you found in his tissue showed that the virus emerged over a century ago. How is that if he was only in his 30s in the 60s?
The nice thing about having a complete genome from that era is you can then plug it in with other genomes sampled later of the virus. And the place where this virus from the 1960s fits in is not the root of the tree. It shows that already by the 1960s, there was a wide diversity of HIV, and it would have taken several decades before this person was infected to generate that diversity. And so we think that the virus probably emerged sometime maybe around 1910. And we had indications from modern sequences that that might be the case. But now we can step back and see, yep, it clearly was evolving for decades before the 1960s.
Which is so fascinating. First of all, there have been documentaries about the person who was said to be ground zero, the first person to transmit the HIV virus. That is automatically not true. Now, if this, you know, proves out that the virus was around for decades before. But also, you have other questions, like maybe HIV was actually behind some other pandemics in history.
You're exactly right. The genetic picture shows very clearly that he was just one of many people who was infected. And I wouldn't say so much that it caused other pandemics, but that it was causing deaths throughout virtually the whole 20th century without anyone noticing. And that's because it destroys your immune system and you die from other known diseases in Africa, primarily tuberculosis. It took a giant number of people dying before anyone clued in that this was going on.
Boy, again, this hasn't been peer-reviewed, but it's being praised by the top people in the field of HIV research. What does it mean to you, Dr. Warabi, that I think you said this was just in a box, a cardboard box in a big heap? This could have been thrown out.
Yeah, absolutely. So a good chunk of my time over the last 15, 20 years has been just connecting with people and institutions that might have old samples like this. They're important for HIV. They've been super important for influenza. And there are lessons to be learned from these things. So they're important.
Dr. Michael Warabi of the University of Arizona, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And we'll follow this. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here Now.